Do you have a sense of the remnant, the church feeling like itself to be the remnant today, or should it feel that way? If our task is to reach out to the world and have them included in a sense, the remnant is not politically correct. We want to make everybody feel included.
Well, it depends on how you interpret the basic material, but for the kind of stuff we've been going over, which I think gets neglected in most of the church.
Yeah, right.
We just historicize it and say, well, this happened, and there were injustices done, and we don't want to have injustices like that anymore, and so we know better, and everything's
good. And we don't have wars like that.
Yeah.
Sure.
I don't want to tear my hair out, because people don't really look to see... One, they don't look to really see God at work there, and they don't make the transition to see God at work
here.
I really don't see much of that. It's considered to be an archaic
notion,
yeah, primitive kind of thing.
You mean the remnant or the church?
Well, interpreting scripture to find God at work, really, besides through moral concepts.
People don't even think
that's
of
a good point.
Our God is a God of history. They think of God in a very different way.
As laying down some rules we should live by.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we argue about what the rules are.
Yeah.
But the remnant, to me, the remnant theology, ultimately Jesus is the fulfillment of the remnant.
Right. It's Israel
Jesus
reduced
is
to one,
the,
as they said.
The righteous man. Mm-hmm. Through whom God fulfills the promises. To me, that's the role of the remnant. Not to be a righteous body, but to be the agent of the fulfilling of the promises.
Yeah, and as somebody, you know, who's a cool mind points, it's sort of like an hourglass. It's God's covenant with creation and Noah and, you know, Moses, and then the prophetic remnant within, or David, the monarchy, and David, and the prophetic remnant within, and finally it's down to Jesus, Israel reduced to one, and then you have the 12, and then you have the Jewish Pentecost, and then you have the Gentile Pentecost, and then you have the great missionary expansion, and then the ecumenical church throughout the world. It's supposed to go like this, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But that may be too neat.
Well, except it does seem to kind of
fit. Yeah, Jesus is the remnant.
Well, we always are looking for neat answers.
But then Luther talked, you know, about the ecclesiola in ecclesia, the church within the church. Is that a viable notion?
I think it's a fact.
I think it's more than one church within the church.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between, you know, what is the institution and what is the body of Christ.
Right.
And things haven't changed that much since Luther. It's just that there are more institutions to be confused by.
Yeah.
Right. More churches within more churches.
Right.
Seed
complexity of churches, which leads us to the science of complexity, which is on the rise now.
Yes.
How do you deal with complexities that can't be reduced to simple terms? But there is an authority in complexities.
How do you even get people to be challenged by trying to understand the complexities? I think our tendency is to want to simplify things, not understand the complexities. And it's a lifetime.
Well, now in 2 weeks I got to go to the UPS and deal with the ecumenical movement. Does this relate to any of what we're doing here?
Sort of. Although I was amazed, I didn't get much of a rise out of it. That's, you know, kind of a passion for me now, because the formal movement relating institutions to institutions doesn't seem to be doing much. You run into all those power issues that you get tired of.
Yeah,
that's right.
But there is always, there's a real conservative ecumenical thing going on right now worldwide that's really kind of exciting, I think. But there are, you know, spiritual is such a strange word, but I, you know, the political, some political concerns bridge denominations.
Mm-hmm.
But I was trying to suggest to Bob that the environmental kind of stuff is a bridging, can be a bridging.
Mm-hmm.
cause, but he didn't see that.
Those that have a concern for the environment would find a spirituality that would draw them together? Is that what you're...
Not a spirituality so much, but a critical look at our broader environment now from that point of view that can draw people from a variety of denominational outlooks to look at the relationship between God and nature in a common way.
Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that's ecumenical.
Now,
but sometimes in those kinds of causes, if that becomes what we see as being either the remnant or the spread of the gospel, it really falls short because they become caught up in their issues of ecology or,
right,
you know, I thought of like the Barman Symposium where we really felt there were a lot of people there from very ecumenical. The peace movement was one, very ecumenical. But it was not only ecumenical, but there were all ranges of faith and from atheists to very conservative people. And so then as far as being the body of Christ, I think then we cannot hope that in those kinds of things that would draw us together, we will function as the body of Christ.
Yeah, that's what I would push a little farther and say somewhere my ideal is that there's a key to get beyond the limiting cause, the issue, and into the relationship that involves us and God and Jesus, embedded in the cause. It's kind of like church within
right.
the church, except it's the cause within the cause.
Mm-hmm. So it opens up to those interested in that cause and called by that cause to a exposure of...
Well, should the church feel like... I mean, we are always talking about how there's so many vast cultural forces that we seem to have so little handle on to be able to control that in a sense we're victimized by them, and maybe we overplay that, maybe we underplay that. But should we feel like a besieged city, like a remnant that has been spared or that is called to witness? Or Auerwas and Willimon wrote this book, Resident Aliens. Should we feel like resident aliens in a culture that is just incomprehensible to, I mean, uncomprehending of the gospel? Or what is there anything we can learn from this that is applicable today?
Yeah. The pilgrimage and Exodus paradigm was popular when I was in seminary, and it never felt right. It's kind of this happy-go-lucky, we're all on the road to
promised land,
better horizons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to the promised land and the exile. I don't know when Auerwas wrote that book. But
just a couple, three or four years ago.
Well, I was onto it long before he was.
So was I.
He had a book.
So was I.
Exile matched my...
Yeah, I
got to be my personal stance trying to make my way through all this, but this is a one that I really haven't. This is the one that you'll find in conservative and fundamentalist circles more, really.
They look at
themselves
as the besieged city.
Rather selfish, self-righteously as the remnant.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, self-righteousness pops out of the cauldron, but it isn't universal.
Yes.
Gets seen and noted a lot.
Well, and they, in fact, they see themselves as the persecuted remnant often, don't they?
But I think one of our issues, if we're going to be ecumenical, is to not give that any more credence than the hypocrisy that pops out on liberal
issues.
Yeah, well, right.
Six of one, half dozen of the other.
You bet.
If you just look at what you see in the papers and on the TV. But that is, I think, the paradigm of the besieged city. I think where the mistake comes is how they respond to their own paradigm is what is God's intention
right
with the remnant.
I mean, you know, you think of the paradox of Jesus. In one place says, you know, many are called and few are chosen. Those that are not with me are against me, and those that are not against me are with me. That sort of thing. There's a sort of a separating out in order to include. That's what the church is. We are people called out in order to embrace all. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we forget that. We become the little flock unspotted from the world.
Yeah.
Or we become so dissipated in trying to identify with the world that we have no identity as church.
That's why I think that we can be involved in causes that we have to drain our strength from being less inclusive. We have to pull back into the small remnant and strengthen ourselves and then reach out to people. Beyond the remnant, beyond that, what happens in the Old Testament?
Well, maybe the remnant isn't even applicable to the church, just to Israel. What about that?
Well, just what I'm trying to lead to is that are we called? Well, you're talking about the hourglass. Are we called then to be the crucified ones with Christ? I mean, do we start up here in the hourglass and we're talking now about the remnant? Then we do. Do we in our own personal lives?
Well, presumably our baptism and our election and our, even though it is, of course, an act of grace, sets a people apart. But the purpose of the setting the people apart, just as it was for Israel, and Israel forgot it as well as the church does, is to be a light to the nations. Some have criticized the resident aliens movement of Hauerwas and Willimon as being a little too smug about all that. Mm-hmm. We are the resident aliens, and we become the elite and the elect, and maybe they're a little too, drawing the circle a little too narrow there. But on the other hand, we're supposed to be the salt and the leaven, mm-hmm. you know, and relate to the world. God so loved the world, not the church. The church is supposed to be ambassadors of that and witnesses to that and share the light of that.
But I don't think this is a linear thing. I think, you know, that in history there's always the historical times when the church itself is persecuted, or individuals are devastated, where the church becomes polluted by idols, and I mean, I think that, you know, it's a constant repeating of history.
Can the church be Hezekiah or Ahaz?
I don't think so. Not like that.
Not like
that.
It
seems to me that the ultimate image for pilgrimage, alienation, and the besieged Jerusalem in Jesus is being crucified outside the city.
Outside the city.
On the garbage dump.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where, that's what Charlie was trying to get across last night, I think. We've talked about that.
Charlie.
The musician.
At the Vespers, you mean, or just in personal conversation?
But we want to stay inside the city walls all the time.
So. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course, the city got wiped out in Babylonian.
That's what I wanted you to say. Is that beyond this, there is.
But the remnant went into exile.
The very next king goes right back to the.
Oh, sure. Manasseh. Yeah. Manasseh undid everything Hezekiah.
Became the worst of the worst.
Although he becomes an example of repentance, too, which is interesting. Manasseh does. I was reading ahead.
Oh, you mean at near the end of his life?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even after all this awful stuff, so there's another element of grace, or you know, what it means to be the remnant. Stuff.
Like Julian the apostate. Thou was conquered, O pale Galilean.
He never repented.
The world has grown gray with thy breath, says Swinburne. Well, I mean, all paradigms are only of limited use, because every historical situation has its own variables. And even though they are of use, and my whole point in this is that, I guess, is that to discover, well, several things. I feel this psalm has not had a good press or enough research into it, and I feel that crisis has been sort of overlooked. They jumped from Exodus to monarchy to exile, and if it hadn't been for what happened here, the country would have ceased to exist before the Babylonians even came on the scene.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly opened up a lot of Isaiah to me, sitting in on a class.
Is that right?
Yeah, so I appreciate that.
It's very interesting stuff.
And this paradigm would fit the Holocaust more than the others, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting point.
And what is a modern Assyria where you just want to wipe out the whole memory?
Sure.
But we do that.
I kept saying, talking about the Third Reich, but I was thinking more of the church than the Jews, but you're right. The Jews, when I identify with this, more than the church. Huh?
And that whole process of, which I really, you know, I guess I can get hyperbolic and turn people off, but I see the spirit of National Socialism is still very much a motivating thing. It's kind of it's a deception that it was defeated by force of arms, quote unquote.
Mm. Yeah.
That we had to resort to so much destruction in order to destroy it.
No, you can kill men, but you can't kill an idea.
Yeah, you can't kill an idea. And that whole way that the Jews were treated in Germany as if they didn't exist, long before an individual Jew went into the oven,
mm-hmm.
that Jew was treated by the society as if he or she wasn't even there.
Did you see Schindler's List?
Yeah.
Wasn't that powerful?
Yeah, that was powerful. We were casting out one day with our 14-year-old who's junior high. I think it was his social studies teacher required them to see it. Mm-hmm. That was nice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the first full theater I've been in a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, multiple theaters, never filled out. It was packed.
Yeah.
And when the credits came on, I just sat there kind of gushing like Niagara Falls.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't sobbing or grief. It was just real
devastation.
Yeah. And Katrin was sitting there gushing.
Yeah.
And I looked around and everybody in the theater is just sitting there.
Yeah.
And nobody got up.
The Lutheran pastor, associate pastor at Holy Trinity in Port Angeles, he took two youth groups to see it. The first, they were going to go have pizza afterward and discuss it. And,
right.
And he said the kids couldn't even eat. And that says something for this culture when they see so much, they're so bombarded with violence and the media and all of that, that for something like that to get to them in reality, I think is very important.
Because that's a different kind of violence. That's a spiritual violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you can fantasize being rough and tough and being able to fight off the gangsters and the IRS or, you know, almost any enemy that you can conjure up, but there's no way you can.
But there's still an element there of dehumanizing the enemy, of making them not as if they are, have no spirit themselves.
No existence.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And it's not even in near the depth at which the Nazis went.
No, but we did that with communists in the 50s.
Yeah, I mean, we're capable of that. That's why that movie really cut me to the core, because I knew that...
Still going on.
That, yeah, as human beings, we are capable of those kinds of atrocities.
Well, look at Bosnia and all that jazz. I mean, those people got along pretty well for a long time under communism because they had a universal view of human nature that kept them in check. And now all their particularities have surfaced and they hate each other.
Yeah, and they're mixed up. Think of what real radical ethnicity would do in this country.
Isn't that scary?
There's no way. I mean, because we're all so mixed up and there just aren't any boundaries anymore. It's an interesting... Historically, I think it's unique.
It's hard to say. Melting pot?
Yeah.
The veneer of civilization is very, very thin. And if things got bad enough, you just wonder what kind of genies would jump out of the bottle. I don't know.
So, are we besieged?
I don't know. Is that a myth or is that the truth?
It seems like we're besieging each other most of the time.
There's something to that, too.
Maybe the better image is Jerusalem under siege during Roman times when they were killing each other and eating their babies and all of that. That's a little harder. A little harder image. More apocalyptic. But I really, that's...
How can you be besieged by a culture that's indifferent to you?
Well, Rome was indifferent to Jerusalem.
Oh, I know, but I mean, how can you feel that you're besieged when people, it's not like they regard you as the enemy, it's like they just don't regard you at all.
Yeah.
But it's very subtle to be besieged can be, I mean, you think of that word and you think of it as being...
surrounded.
Yeah, very, very strong forces against you and very obvious and very violent. But I think that... as Christians, we are besieged in very quiet, individual kind of ways. Things that happen to individual congregations, that happen to individuals within the congregation. Those are the kinds of things that we don't see as the enemy. We don't identify them as the enemy.
Here's four examples from... I got four examples. Usually I have three because it's so absurd. But that's been, the thing I've just beaten to death in the pulpit and probably enough to make people want to crucify me, the leaven image of getting out into the workplace.
Leaven?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I haven't talked leaven, but just used different images. And I guess if I had a platform, that's it, because people that are still there recognized what I was getting at. Mm-hmm. But just four different examples that we had some testimonies 5 years ago. And it just blew me away. The congregation was kind of accustomed to that. And five people stood up and gave a testimony of Jesus in their life and in the workplace, including a circuit court judge. But one fellow got up and said, "Well, I tried to apply Christian principles in my job and I got fired and it took me 6 months to find another job and I'm never going to do that again." That was his testimony.
Yeah.
And then he quit the church. He went somewhere else because he couldn't deal with the
agenda.
See, that's the
And that's where the pressure, that's where the besiegement comes in. It's mm-hmm. not a political thing. Mm-hmm. It's not a government thing,
right.
Really. My dad and I went around and I was working with him and I was just beginning to get involved in the church and to have some kind of real own faith. And he, and I don't think this is uncommon, he'd say, "Religion is in church on Sunday. Business is on the sales floor Monday through Saturday. And they don't go together."
Don't mix.
Yeah,
and what do you do with that? There's another one, a fellow that ended up being kind of my Judas, and he's an Intel manager.
Intel manager?
Yeah, and just an example of his kind of trying to take some of these ideas into Intel. He said they were doing some kind of New Age stuff, which they do in big corporations anymore, to get basically to pump people up so they'll work harder for less future. But they were asking the people in the room who their hero was, which is kind of new, really, and interesting. Mm-hmm. Jack said publicly Jesus was his hero, which was a bold thing to do. Mm-hmm. And it really encouraged me. 2 years later, he's talking about firing people at the drop of a hat, and he's learned how to, you know, roll with the punches on that, and it's not any big deal because his faith helps him get through. Well, yeah. it's kind of the Intel culture has clearly just taken over Jesus there. And
yeah.
As another Intel manager I know is struggling, as he's a very, very capable engineer. But he's also, he's Japanese American, so the ethnicity stuff is there, but not so much at Intel. But I think it gets to him when he goes to Intel in Tel Aviv, though that doesn't really jar him too much, but there's a big enough Intel operation in Haiti that he's off to Haiti for a week at a time quite often. I mentioned that to Bob, he didn't believe me, but that's been true for years. And every time he comes back, he's just really shaken by the contrast between
cultures.
Intel sitting there and the reality of the life of the people.
Oh,
so,
but
the besiegement is, you know, he's got the Christian vision and it just simply can't get through the wall, the barrier. It can't. That's what I see all the time. It just...
There it is. We've seen the same thing in the academic world. And we've noticed how it's very interesting that often some excellent people get the shaft, and they're church people, and they're not even the fundy witnessing to their they're often they're just
okay, if those people are often left alone.
Usually the fundy witnessing people can play both games real well. I don't know how they reconcile it.
Yeah, but these are people who just put their faith into their work and are
open
and gracious and reconciling and get the chop.
Yeah.
Like I said, I had to go to the president of Gallaudet University here one day. Because so many people in my congregation, excellent people.
But it isn't only the Methodist congregation.
Oh, no.
You know, it's very Christian. Ecumenical.
Yeah, that is an ecumenical.
Well, I mean, Bunky Larvae, you know, he's aware of
He's had years of dealing with that.
He's been there longer than we were. He's been there twice longer than I've been there. And we were working hand in glove with him and the common ministry, and it's just amazing how these people... And there's the besiegement. Mm-hmm. And it's so subtle sometimes. You know, you wonder, is it really even true? Or are other people getting the shaft like Christians are?
We had no concept of this when we moved to Pullman. It was something we had to have light shed on.
Well, I don't know. I saw it at Wenatchee Valley College a bit. But we had an inkling and an intuition it could be that way, but now we've got data. You know. Or did you do your four examples?
Hmm?
How many examples have you got through?
Oh, that was four, believe it or not.
My nephew just went to work for Intel. Poor. Gets a better warning, huh?
Well, whether it's Intel or the church getting more corporate or academia, the whole notion of these kinds of transcultural institutions that have
co-opt the church.
Power. Well, they co-opt everything.
Yeah.
You know, that's a real ecumenical issue. That was a topic of some concern 15 years ago, and then suddenly it just kind of fizzled away. I think
it was
popular, the whole notion of what kind of power and authority an international institution corporation mm-hmm. has. It was kind of tied on to the issues of Gerber Foods in Africa,
third world countries
in South Africa,
Nestle.
And so as long as it was tied into a specific moral concern, then people noticed how powerful those corporations are. But now you don't hear a whole lot about it. But I think that's a real compromising thing. So they have as much power more than a nation anymore.
Oh, more, much more.
Yeah.
They do.
It's just like, what was this issue we were dealing with a while back? What the heck was it? Well, it's true in the whole environmental deal too. How can a nation control what is virtually an international situation? You know, we can pass laws that you can't do this or that or whatever, but they only hold within our territorial jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And there was a particular issue a while back that we were talking about. What was it?
What is it? Jobs.
Huh?
Other countries?
No, it was something.
Fish. All those fishing issues involved in it.
Well, and timber. Yeah.
Well, just being that the world is a international.
International cartels and multinational corporations don't answer to a particular national. You know, you can pass a law in Congress, big deal. Say, take their factory to Mexico, or
they don't answer to people. They don't answer to a popular vote, or the only governing forces are their boards, and they are all economically driven. So,
yeah.
See, that's the most ironic thing. I grew up in a real hardcore entrepreneurial philosophy. Dad and I think we finally recognized the gulf between us this summer. I mean, that is, people think, well, it's the free market and entrepreneurialism and all this and more things available to more people. And the theory being that the price goes down and you have this equality, but it actually never works that way. And yet that keeps on being spouted as, it's like this carrot out there that people keep believing.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, we're up to this museum, and you know, if the EPA decides that all of that tailing must be removed. Ben was telling us that it's supposed to go back on the...
If they can find holdings from the original company, they will be the ones
they have to pay for it.
But that's very difficult.
If they can't, then it comes down on Holden Village, and they will bankrupt them.
Lutheran Church.
Yeah. It will. And I told him, you better have some pretty sharp corporate lawyers working for you. Because there's no way are any international mining interests going to pay for that. I mean, they will fight it tooth and nail.
If that isn't being besieged, what is?
Right there.
There's a
city besieged. Good point. There's a city besieged by regulations, government, and corporate interests.
And that's going to affect your relationships and everything in a place like this.
Yes.
Wondering.
And yet, you know, he cites that thing, let the buyer beware. Holden, the church bought this property, so now it's our responsibility, so to speak. just like these things they're digging up. That ain't cheap. And
besides the big water pipes and the products that pour me out.
I was thinking that plumber. This is way off the off base, but in that little town in Arizona, it seemed like a regular pattern for the street department to repave a road and then the water department to dig it up the next
day. Yeah, it happens all the time. Happens everywhere. Why don't they get it together? Trying to keep jobs, I guess.
Keep jobs.
But this place could fold.
Just some, like the mine did. He was telling us, Ed was doing the slideshow for us, and he said there was a picture, that most of those pictures were pictures that were taken in May of 57. And he said in June of 57, this place was emptied out.
Have you heard this?
Gone.
Well, that happened. Arizona's full of places like that.
They left their possessions and everything, their homes, and left. The company didn't get, there was no warning. They were just told, the last boat out is, and
tomorrow. And they just left everything, and just like he says they came back. He talked to a guy here at a miners' reunion, and he says he came back about a few weeks later or something here, and came up in here, and he go in these houses, and it's just like they had put their coat on and walked out the door.
Yeah.
Stuff sitting on the table.
Well, see, that's the irony. What's going to happen here is finally somebody will decide that there should have been some care taken here, and then who gets stuck with it? The church that's trying to raise awareness, which is one of the reasons why.
Right.
But the mines, I mean, in Arizona, the mines have owned the government from the day it became a state. They have had no accountability. Real, reasonable accountability ever, even now.
And he said that this mining company was a model of you know, say, in that day, you know, that was in the
and they cared for their people, and they were very good in many ways, and they were very environmentally conscious.
Environmentally conscious because of the way they mined.
But here's the irony.
Is another thing.
Here's the irony of this old guy,
Freed,
you know. He wrote them and got them to give it to the church, and it might bankrupt the church. And here he's a hero. Mm-hmm. The poor guy might have sold us out and not even know it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not even know it. You just can't.
Yeah.
You can't tell.
Well, you can't fault him for that.
Yeah,
but,
no.
I think that's a neat thing that he did. Mm-hmm.
I do too. But it could all go poof.
Yeah.
And if I was the Lutheran Church, I'd take it clear to the Supreme Court.
Well, an example being besieged, that's much easier to, less complicated, is in our conference, we had a pastor who had a two-point charge, and one of the old churches and one church burnt down. And he
just over the mountain here, Winthrop.
He's a very young, well-loved pastor.
In fact, his name is Hutchins.
Mm-hmm.
There was no relation to me.
and within a year's time, was it a year? I'm not sure about all the facts here.
Two years.
His second church burned down, and he was charged with arson. And his members of his congregation stood behind him. I don't know that the whole church did. I'm sure there was some division there. They had bought some property and were going to build another. It looked very bad. Circumstantial evidence was very bad. So then he was charged with arson and
made the headlines.
The
probably
conference,
saw it.
I think the conference did a very good thing. Our bishop did a very good thing. He sent out a letter that was supporting him, not dealing with guilt or non-guilt, but just that, you know,
innocent until proven guilty.
Just that we would pray for him and all that.
Yeah.
But the press was calling the arson parson.
But that's how the culture has changed. An indictment means you're guilty.
Oh,
that's right.
That's the end of your life.
Right.
But now they have found out that their dropped charges have now been dropped just in the last month.
And they cannot recharge
because they discovered that it was the insurance investigators
that
went to the prosecutor and laid it on him that this was arson.
Yeah, but see, you get off on a technicality, but mm-hmm. people will still be wondering.
Right. This is going to affect that man, his family, the personal life, the church.
And yet the judge dismissed it with, what do they call it? Without prejudice.
Prejudice, which means they cannot reach.
They can't do it, charge him again.
But again, people could look at that and say, well, you know, they let him off because of some technicality. But,
yeah, right.
I mean, what I'm trying to point out is that the church, the remnant, supported him, tried to give him strength through a personal attack. And we're attacked all the time in various ways. And if we don't have a way of supporting each other, if our faith is not strong enough, and then if we don't have ways in which we can reach out to others, and through our worship and our caring for others, then the enemy might win.
Well, that's a big issue in our church. One of the, I mean, really, really, really scary things for me. It's still scary going through a termination. Mm-hmm.
You are now terminated?
Yeah, I'm terminated.
From your parish?
Yeah.
Jeez.
I was talking to other clergy just in the Diocese of Oregon who are not employed for one reason or another. And it's like, you know, the beggars of Calcutta,
practically.
Yeah. They're just nowhere.
Yeah.
And
if you've been terminated, it's going to be very tough to get it.
There's no one, all of this, the psycho-emotional issues that
they don't deal with that. Loaded.
Well, there's no place to go.
No one to.
And the corporation just kind of trundles along.
Uh-huh.
It's like, it's a devastated zone. It's really...
Oh, I understand that.
Yeah.
And that happened to me at the university.
What you run into with the church and with a church career is that wall of besiegement, because your experience as a church person is utterly meaningless.
Yeah.
To the rest of
the corporate world.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
That's right.
The one fellow I was talking to, and I knew him before in Arizona, and he's a late 20s, I guess, assistant at a large congregation downtown, and the large congregation got designated the cathedral, and they a new fellow came in after the old guy resigned, and the new fellow was revamping the whole polity and mm-hmm. vision and using corporate procedure, which is to terminate the staff that was there already, which to me is totally uncalled for, but that happens all the time.
Yeah.
So Christian. Scott is suddenly out on the street. I mean, like that.
Just like that.
And he's got, 7 years experience as a priest. He got a job at Nordstrom's. Yeah, I got this out of him. I took him to lunch. And selling suits. And he told me two things that are part of my storehouse now. He said, you know, I get paid about a fourth as much at Nordstrom's as I did as an assistant, which of course tells you a lot right there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to put in your 8 hours on the concrete floor and all that. But he said, what I've discovered at Nordstrom's, and I've heard this from several other people who got jobs in retail, which in my mind is one of the most inhuman.
Yes.
Slave labor.
Slave labor.
It is.
Well, he said they the atmosphere here and the relationships I have are much friendlier than I ever experienced as a pastor, as a priest in the church.
Is that right?
Yeah. The way the clergy are set up as whatever it is that people have in mind.
Yeah.
And then he said, I topped that off. He said he applied to a job, after working in Nordstrom's for 2 weeks, he applied to a job that was a primarily a public relations kind of people thing. So he went in with his 7 years pastoral experience, thinking, well, this should mean something here. And he said, I got 7 years in the ministry and 2 weeks in Nordstrom. And they proceeded to ask him what he had been doing at Nordstrom's.
Ignored totally experience.
Yeah. Well, that's the way it is, and that's
like it doesn't.
Yeah, and they can't comprehend. It's like a lot of the press cannot comprehend any religious reality.
Well, it's against the law to really comprehend it.
Well, I know. Did you hear about how next week they got a school coming in here?
Yeah.
Do environmental stuff, and they got to come into lunch 5 minutes late, so they'll miss the grace. Last year, one kid got in early or something, and he heard the prayer, and his parents found out about it and wrote him a letter saying, we don't want any more of that. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, that's a crock.
Huh?
That's just...
Yeah.
But that is the kind of... It is a real wall of separation that goes beyond just legalities. And
right.
So I think that...
The same law that separates... guarantees the free exercise thereof. So it's
well, sort of, but see, this is the thing. I'm getting out of history and talking to this real neat Armenian guy in our congregation. He's an Armenian Orthodox Christian, and he grew up in Baghdad. And there's no end to Harry Tanelian just grinding his teeth about what we think freedom of religion is and what the churches are and all that. And, as he said, growing up in Baghdad under a king, the Christian and Jewish and Muslim communities got along perfectly well. They respected each other and were absolutely free to do whatever their religion called them to do.
Yeah.
Anything. And the government respected the integrity of...
Well, that's the way it was in Sarajevo before the...
That's freedom of religion. We don't have that.
That's true. Well, it's a myth. It's just a bloody myth.
It makes me real anxious. We really don't have it. We have less freedom of religion in a cultural sense than the Soviets did. I mean,
that's
right.
Amazing
to me how what we're discovering is that the church went on through all of the lies.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it wasn't just old people that... the veneer fell off, the church popped up, and it's a whole intergenerational.
He was telling his congregation that before communists fell, but some of them would go.
Yeah, they don't believe it.
Does he know what he's talking about?
They don't believe it. Well, it's real now.
In fact, the church is probably more alive than it is now there.
Yeah.
And, I had an interesting thing happen at the University of Idaho. They have this tall tower sort of dorm, named for a former president of the university. And every Christmas break, either the students or the custodian or somebody would have this lighted cross in the windows when the students were gone.
Mm. Well, they'd light the windows.
They'd light the windows.
In the shape of a cross. It was
the shape
huge
of a cross.
In the building.
And, light the windows in this tall shape of a cross. And there'd been discussion about that for a number of years, and finally they were cracking down on it and saying, we can't do this anymore. Whoever's doing it's got to stop. Well, it's very interesting because into the paper they wrote a Hindu professor and a Muslim professor, and they said it didn't bother them. It didn't bother them a bit.
Yeah.
But they had to stop it. And I always wrote a letter to the paper.
No,
I wish
they didn't
I had.
Say they had to stop it.
The university
the
had to
law,
stop
it. Yeah, because
can you imagine
tipping the law.
Trying to stop that kind of expression in India?
Really? Yeah.
the
irony of it was that I should have wrote a letter to the paper, because the irony of it was is that this is the Theophilus Tower. Because the president of the university, whom his name was a Greek
named Theophilus, which means lover of God. I just love it. Talk about irony. It was just wonderful. Yeah. Huh? It's just wonderful.
Yeah. But you look at countries like India, they have to have freedom of religion.
Yeah.
Just to go from one day to another. It's just so many different religions there.
Right.
Yeah. And it makes life a little difficult for the government. That's what it really means.
Well, it's not just religion. We have a great myth here about our political freedom and all of that, but I've experienced more freedom in Canada and in Britain than I can hear. Boy, you're on the wrong side of the political spectrum in a lot of communities, and you are an outcast.
Yeah, you're an outcast.
You're an outcast. Yeah, why were you terminated, or should I ask?
Well, let's see. The high tea crowd left before I got there because they conjured up an image of who I was before they met me.
Yeah, I've run into that one too.
And the Bible-oriented yuppie crowd that was on the search committee that sort of wanted me turned out to have bought into a whole variety of very strange quasi-charismatic and fundamentalist practices that I didn't even know existed before I went here. Really, I can handle mainline fundamentalism, you know, very conservative people. But this is bizarre stuff.
There's a lot around.
And the previous rector was in submission to a charismatic woman who wasn't even a member of the congregation anymore.
Mm-hmm. No kidding?
Yeah, all the lines of authority and any kind of rationality about what the Spirit does and what the Bible means. And I kind of ran into that. It took me 4 years to understand why the other people left when I came, because they just assumed I represented what the other crowd was doing, which I, like I said, I've never seen anything like this happen. And so I never really kind of managed to connect with much of anybody. It got to be, as my colleague in the next town called it, a toxic environment.
Yeah, it sounds like a church in crisis.
Yeah, a real poisonous kind of thing. And the parish itself has a reputation and a history for killing clergy, which I also didn't know.
And yeah.
See, I didn't know any. What it was billed as was a Bible-centered family parish that was ready to take off and really be a happy, peppy. And it was just like civil war.
God, it can get vicious, can't it?
Yeah, it got real vicious. I've been accused of... Probably the next accusation would be that I'm Satan himself.
Oh, yeah.
Jeez.
So I just eventually got real burned out. There's a good core, you know, a small core of people that are decent.
Remnant?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a remnant there, and we actually had a nice parish camp out the week after I was finally terminated with all these people. It's a real strange situation.
You know, I think that's true of a lot of congregations, that there is this remnant of people that really understand
it's the church within
where
the church.
They are, why they're there, who they are, and right, those are the churches within the church that we talked about.
But we got down to a foundation that I still believe could be built on,
mm-hmm.
you know, to build up a healthy environment, except that there were still hangers-on, and all these people that left are still, they're kind of waiting, and mm-hmm. it's a real besiegement, and they keep their connections in the church coming after me, basically, and I got just real, just shredded in a very personal way.
Yeah.
By several people, and I just found I didn't have the energy to even want to deal with it anymore.
The Episcopal Church doesn't have interim pastors that come in and kind of work through some of those
issues? Well, that one didn't get interimed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's one thing I'd already discussed with the bishop when, after I'd been there 2 years and began to wonder what it was going on.
Right.
And we began to look at some of these things, and he was the new bishop when all this process was going on. And so it didn't get done very well. I'm going off at his expense to be trained as an interim now after this. So, you know, as far as the broader professional kind of thing goes, I'm still in good standing, but I've just been struggling with all kinds of extreme feelings this last couple of weeks.
Did you get to talk any with Carol while she was here?
No, she was usually off hiking, and either that or I was too depressed.
Yeah. Well, I think she was trying, she and Tony have a relationship.
Yeah.
She was trying to be supportive of him while she was here, but she serves as an interim.
She's several.
Yeah, that's what she does, isn't it? And Tony.
Yeah, it's a whole kind of interdenomination thing. So I'm really glad to have that opportunity. It gives me at least something to focus on instead of dwelling on all this bizarre. I mean, it just goes
on. Well, that's very devastating, and a person goes through that. I mean, it takes its toll on you emotionally and psychologically and physically, too.
After I went to see the president of the university about all these people in my congregation, they did it to my wife. So we hired a lawyer.
It had nothing any connection with you going to see the president.
No, I have no
politics.
Connection, but I mean,
yeah.
That was the next one.
Yeah.
A year later down the road, and so we took them to the mat, and she got her job back, and then they did it to her again.
Then they were careful the next time to be sure they'd had their case.
Yeah.
And they lied. They lied about her. They spied on her. It was just incredible. We're thinking of writing a novel about that. And so then what happens is the old guy that got
Let's
rid of her.
Let's go on another retreat and work on a novel.
The old guy that got rid of her, guess who they called in to bury him?